Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Growing up, it didn't take me long to learn that my gayness detracted from my blackness. Black gay men are punchlines to the black community, an anomaly to be ridiculed. Relegated to the role of church choir directors, we are a national family secret, courtesy of masculinity and religion.
That's Brian Broom reading an excerpt from his memoir, Punch Me Up to the Gods. When I started reading Brian's book, I felt like I was reading his diary. It's an incredibly intimate experience, and at times I felt like I was invading his privacy. But fortunately for us, Brian had the courage to share his life story. In the book, he revisits his childhood and his formative years growing up in rural Ohio. Along the way, Brian reveals heartbreaking stories about his status as an outsider trying to become part of the in-crowd. We learn about his efforts to soothe his soul with random sexual encounters and alcohol and drugs, and why he named his memoir, Punch Me Up to the Gods.
Basically, it's a rewording of something that my father used to say, but I think sometimes a lot of black parents say, like, I brought you into this world and I'll take you out. My father used to say that he would punch you so hard that you would go back up to God to be remade and reborn so that you were made correctly.
Wow. So how did you feel when he would say that to you?
Well, I mean, I didn't really feel any particular way when he would say that. It was just an expression that was used in the house. So I knew it was a threat, but it came with such regularity that I didn't really feel any particular way about it.
Mm. In your book, you don't shy away from sharing the most heartbreaking details about your life. How difficult was it for you to revisit all of these memories while you were writing the book?
It could get really difficult at times, like sitting alone in a room and trying to really get at the emotion that you were feeling at that time, whether it be embarrassment or shame or sadness. You want to tap into those emotions, and there's really no way to tap into those emotions unless you're kind of feeling them. So I would have to get really deep into the memory and try to feel the same way that I felt then. So at times that was pretty difficult to do.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine it would be. So was writing Punch Me Up to the Gods, was writing it cathartic for you in any way?
Oh, yeah. I don't feel like I have any more secrets. You know, since the book has come out, I've had to explain a lot of things to people in my life who are still in my life about my past, things that I didn't tell them. You know, they're reading them for the first time and they have questions. And I struggled with whether or not I was obligated to answer those questions for the people in my life. And I hope that the book answers some questions that they may have had. But for me, it's been, you know, revelatory. I feel a little bit freer in the world.
That's great. That's good to hear. Do you have a specific audience in mind for your book?
When I started writing the book, I really wanted to connect with young black men and boys, like to, you know, just be a messenger in the sense that of telling them that, you know, you don't have to be this thing that the world keeps telling you that you are, whether that message comes from black people or white people or anybody. You don't have to be this paragon of masculinity. You don't have to be this tough guy. You can be anything you want. You know, this is your life, and you are entitled to all the experiences of the human condition. But then I think as the book has gotten out there, I'm hearing from a lot of different kinds of people who have felt as though the world was trying to place them in this box that they didn't fit into. I'm hearing from a lot of people who grew up with shame the same way that I did. So I'm hoping that now the book can reach people who maybe they feel this way in their own life, or maybe they know somebody who might feel trapped in their own life. So I'm hoping that it can reach different kinds of people at this point.
Yeah, I hope so too, because it's such a beautifully written and powerful piece of work. What were your relationships with your parents like?
Well, I mean, my father was a typical father for the time in the 1970s. He went to work. He worked really hard. He came home tired. He expected his dinner on the table. And he was the man of the house. And so he didn't really, you know, although I know that he loved us, he didn't really engage in the parenting part of that too much. That was, of course, up to the woman, my mother, who took care of cooking and cleaning and the nurturing. You know, my parents were very stoic, I remember, when I was growing up. There wasn't a whole lot of fun to be had, particularly, you know, after my father lost his job. It was, everything was based, basically went into household concerns, like how are we going to keep the lights on? How are we going to keep the gas on, et cetera? So it was run kind of like a business. And, you know, I was like watching TV at the time, and I saw these parents on TV who were super loving and kind and jokey with their kids. I didn't have that kind of relationship with my parents.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, they didn't get along well, especially after your father lost his job, right?
I don't know that they didn't get along well. They just didn't interact. You know, like I said, I mean, unless it was in terms of business. Here's money for the gas bill. Here's money for the phone bill. I didn't ever see them have any sort of like alone moments together or any affection between them. It was very, very officious, their dealings with each other.
How did your relationships with your parents, how did those relationships affect the way you thought about yourself?
Well, I don't know. I think that I just thought that this was the normal way that a family ran, or at least it was just the normal way my family ran. I didn't really feel like I had a whole lot of support because, you know, school, I think, was just a way for my parents to get rid of us for a while they did what they had to do. So they weren't really into my schoolwork. They were just busy. And I think it kind of left me to my own devices, which is when I kind of started scribbling and writing and doing things. I gave up on the idea of my parents sort of noticing me pretty early on.
Hmm. There's a beautiful chapter that you wrote from your mother's point of view. Why did you decide to write this chapter?
Well, basically, I think by the time I had gotten to that point in the book, I was just tired of my own voice. And I realized over the years, my mother and my relationship has gotten closer. I realized that her story is a significant part of my story. I mean, everybody's mother story is. And so I just wanted her in there. I wanted her voice in there to just give a broader picture. This is a memoir. And I think if anybody writes a memoir, they should include their mom's voice. Because if you want a bigger picture of yourself, talk to your mom. Your mom knows things about you that you don't even know. And I also just really thought it would broaden the scope of the narrative to hear from her and where she came from and what her hopes and dreams were.
Mm-hmm. It definitely did. I thought that was like a really brilliant move on your part to do that. Did you ever consider writing a chapter from your father's point of view?
I did. I did, really. And I'm still thinking about that. You know, maybe something in the future might include his voice. But at the time, I really don't know enough about my father to be able to write a chapter about him. For the chapter in Punch Me Up to the Gods, that is my mother's voice, I interviewed her and I talked to her about different points in her life and, you know, asked her about things. My father and I never had a conversation where I could glean information about his life. The things that I've learned about him, I have learned from other relatives, and his upbringing wasn't great. And so I would really love to explore what made him the man that he was.
Mm-hmm. You cover your relationship between identifying as gay and the concept of Black masculinity. How has this intersection influenced the way you've lived your life?
Well, I think that I have grown up with a terror of being perceived as effeminate, because any sort of behavior that was considered feminine when I was growing up was just basically beat out of you or shamed out of you, because there's a stereotype. Uber masculine, cool, athletic, strong, and stoic man. And so I think that there are things in my life that I've avoided doing that I've really wanted to do that I didn't do because of the perception of being feminine. Which, you know, now at my age, it feels silly. But I think that there are things that I missed out on that I didn't do that, you know, writing was one of them, right? I didn't write for a very, very long time because my cousin told me when I was very young that it was quote unquote faggy to be sitting around writing. So I stopped. I think I probably would have written something much sooner had I not had that implanted in my brain at a very young age.
I was really struck by your confession that the biggest failing in your life has been your gasping need to be loved at the expense of so many other things. Can you tell us about this?
I think that I grew up thinking that the single greatest accomplishment a person could do was to be loved by everybody, to be like, that meant that you were likable, that meant that you were lovable, that meant that you were worthy of love. I've since found out that in life, I think that if absolutely everybody likes you, you're probably a psychopath of some kind. I went out of my way to try to be all things to all people. I lied about, you know, my background. I lied about who I was. I just told these lies in order to make people like me, or to make them think I was worthy of their liking me. And so I think I really did myself a disservice in doing that. I never really got to explore who I actually was, because I was constantly sort of putting on these performances for whomever I was around at the time. That is where a lot of the drinking came in, because when I was drinking, I was a performing bear. I just was the life of the party all the time, and everybody loved me. But when the bar closes, you're still as alone as you were before. And I think that it maybe goes back to your other question about, you know, my parents didn't really show me a whole lot of attention because they were very busy. I didn't feel loved. And so I think later on in life, I just went looking for it, no matter what form it came in, no matter if it was toxic, no matter if it was disingenuous. I just wanted that feeling of being accepted and taken under somebody's wing, or something like that. And it just led me down a lot of dark places.
You include a very powerful quote from James Baldwin in your memoir. It's a quote I've never encountered before, and I was kind of embarrassed to admit that I hadn't read it. So thank you for introducing me to it. Would you mind reading it for us and telling us what it means to you?
Sure. The quote is, "The details and symbols of your life have been deliberately constructed to make you believe what white people say about you. Please try to remember that what they believe, as well as what they do and cause you to endure, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear." It's from The Fire Next Time. Black people have a very difficult time in this country. I think that, unfortunately, one of the functions of this idea of white people and black people is to ensure that white people always can feel better about themselves, no matter what. At least I am better than black people. This is something that I grew up with growing up and going to a predominantly white school. And I think that somebody once said, he was a white man who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, "The idea is to make even the lowest white man still feel better than the highest black man." I think a lot of things that we're told about ourselves as black people in this country are profoundly untrue. We grow up under this idea that we are this other form of human being, that we're a different species and a lower species at that. A lot of things in America systemically are constructed to keep us feeling that way and to make sure that white people still feel good about themselves and superior at all times. I think a friend of mine once said to me, you know, white people are people. They get to just be people. And black people get to be this other thing, black people, which comes with this, a lot of other like attendant supposed characteristics or whatever that we have to contend with mentally. So I think that that's what that quote means. James Baldwin is talking to a young black man in it and saying, the things that you see around you are constructed to make you believe that you are something other than a full human being. Don't believe it. These things are constructed by people who thrive on you feeling as though you are less than.
That's right. Thank you. That was a very, very great analysis of it. And I think that's why it resonated so strongly with me. Yes. Near the end of your memoir, you confess that you have spent a lifetime giving up in one way or another, but you didn't give up on writing your beautiful memoir, which was receiving a lot of great reviews. Do you think that this marks a turning point in your life as you move forward?
Oh God, I hope so. I still struggle with that. Oh, you know, I'm not good enough. You know, I can't do this. I still do sometimes. But I do notice more times now where I am raring to go. I can do this. I can do this. And I've taken on more things that I thought that I couldn't do. I've been challenging myself more. So I do think that this book being in the world has broken something in me that needed to be broken, or maybe just hobbled it a little bit, you know, this insecurity around everything that I do. So I definitely am looking toward the future and looking for ways to challenge myself and to try not to be afraid to fail at things. I just feel like now I'm living more than I have been ever before in my life.
That's good to know. And you should be feeling that way. It's too bad you weren't feeling that way sooner, but better late than never. Brian Broom, thank you so much for joining us today. And congratulations on Punch Me Up to the Gods. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Brian Broom is the author of the memoir, Punch Me Up to the Gods. You can find out more about Brian at wpr.org/beta.
In the plot, it also seems at several points that maybe Thomas has lost a day and arrived somewhere the day before he left, although we don't know whether that's really true or whether someone is messing with him.
Novelist Stephen Hall joins us to talk about his latest mysterious mind-bending novel, Maxwell's Demon. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.